One of the most important things to know about Marine Sergeant Byron Hancock is how good he was at his job. During much of the time Byron spent in Iraq, he was a sniper. He was one of the best. While he was overseas, the Marines announced that Byron had registered the longest confirmed kill in Iraq, a single shot of his that killed an insurgent at a distance of over 1,000 yards. The people who work as snipers in a war zone like Iraq are revered by their colleagues. They're the ones who take out enemy snipers. They're the people who make it safe for soldiers and Marines on the ground. But it's dreadful work. All the time you're stalking and waiting, you know that someone on the other side is waiting for the chance to kill you. Imagine spending months under that kind of pressure, and you're imagining precisely what leads to post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
President Bush announced yesterday that he'll be shortening the tours of duty for U.S. service people in Iraq from 15 months to 12. And still, tens of thousands of those men and women coming home will return and will have to deal with the trauma they experienced in the form of nightmares and flashbacks. The story of Marine Sergeant Byron Hancock begins back in the worst months of the conflict in Iraq, back in 2004 and 5. One day, he was assigned to watch a key bridge over a river near where some IEDs, some buried bombs, had been found. Byron and his spotter slipped into the area, dug themselves into a hide, and waited.
We watched it for about a day, and then I saw a kid on a motorcycle driving around like he was looking for something, you know. And he had been fooling around exactly where the IEDs were found. So,
could you tell how old he was, Byron?
Oh, he was young. He was probably, I'm guessing, 14. Younger, I don't know. He was a young kid. And what the insurgents would do, they would use these kids or, you know, certain individuals to plant these IEDs, spot for them, you know, things like that, because knowing that we wouldn't shoot kids. Well, anyway, we're laying down there, and I see him come back on the second day we're there, and I'm like, look, this guy here, there's something else down there. You know, they must have planted some more IEDs or something like that, and he's looking for the wires or something. So we down watch him. And this day was like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Well, the next day he comes back at 2, and then he comes back at 3 the next day. I called this in every day. And the fourth day I called it in, and they said, well, if you don't have enough probable cause by now, we're going to give you one more day. And if he doesn't do anything overtly evident that he's has hostile intents toward coalition forces, then you need to pull out. I said, okay. Well, here he comes back on the fifth day, and this time he got off his bike, and he was looking for some wires, and that's when I engaged him. And we found two IEDs on the bridge, and then we found three IEDs about 300 yards behind it. And what they were doing was, you know, they would hit us at the bridge. Everybody would fall back into a security position, and that's where they had the second set of IEDs. So they had it planned out. I mean, they were planning on hitting us as soon as we come across that bridge.
Byron, let me ask you a little something about working as a sniper, because one of the things that distinguishes your job from other soldiers is that you're looking through that high-powered scope and you're seeing the people that you end up shooting. Do you get to a kind of familiarity with them before you have to kill them?
It first didn't start out like that when I was over there, because everything was so fast and rapid, and there were, you know, firefights and things like that, and, you know, there wasn't a lot. The rules of engagement were kind of loose. But as the rules of engagement tightened up, you had to develop probable cause to engage them. You know, you see somebody acting suspiciously, we had to watch them for a long time. So, yeah, you see facial characteristics. You see mannerisms, height, weight, you know, people they talk to. You know, they become a person to you, I guess you'd say.
The way Byron tells it, his unit was so busy in Iraq, moving from place to place and fight to fight, that when their orders to go home arrived, no one even knew it.
We got through with the last operation, and they put us on a truck. Of course, we were all thinking that we were fitting out to go somewhere else. You know, they told us we were getting extended and all that. But halfway there, they told us orders had changed. we're going to Al Asad Air Base, going to turn our gear in, and we're going to be in Kuwait the next day. And as soon as we went in the outside, the outer perimeter wire there at Al Asad Air Base, and we took our weapons out of condition one and went to, you know, made them safe, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
That's when it hit. That's when everybody started hooping and hollering, and I mean, people were just jumping up and down, hugging each other, said, "Dadgum," you know, because it was a I guess that's one of the moments you'll never forget, you know. It was the, I guess that was a defining moment for me.
Byron's wife, Christy Hancock, had spent the better part of a year on her own with the family's four children in Bryan, Texas. She's a teacher. She remembers that it was late when the call came in from Byron at the airbase.
I had already put the kids to bed and was sitting down and grading a great big stack of papers when the phone rang, and I always got nervous when it rang after 9 o'clock. But the phone rang, and he said, "Well, I'm turning my stuff in, and it's real. We're going to be coming home, and we'll be home in this many days." And I remember waking the kids up so they could come and hear it from him themselves.
What did you do at home to get ready for Byron's return?
We made posters and signs and just contacted everybody we could think of in the family. And I probably painted a room or two in the house. I'm not real sure. I'd stay really busy while he's gone, give myself little projects. So I'm sure I finished up whatever was left over. I did prepare the kids before he came back. We have a good friend who's a child therapist, and we sat down with her and talked about, you know, keeping things calm and not planning things and some of the changes that we might see in Dad and how he might be not wanting to get out of the house and do a whole lot right at first. So I did prepare them that way, that if Dad didn't quite seem like himself, it's just because he wasn't used to being in a place where he didn't have to always be on guard, you know, where he wasn't in danger. So most of the time we were just so excited. You don't have a lot of time to think about what might not go right.
Sure enough, Byron Hancock came home, and he had a hard time shifting back into being a father and a husband. His temper was quick, particularly with his teenage daughter, Madison, who'd grown up a lot while he was away. Byron says he had the nightmares and the flashbacks, and they kept on coming.
Yeah, I figured that was normal. I was kind of thinking that it would eventually go away.
But this had been going on for weeks now, months, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. But I just, you know, I was like, well, it'll go away, you know, surely. But when I really noticed it was when I saw, well, like when I would get upset, I saw the fear in my kids' eyes. You know, I could tell that they'd start crying, or they would get upset, or they'd all go in a room and shut the door. You know,
did you ever threaten them?
Well, I threatened to spank them, I'm sure, I was just not really threatening to beat them or anything like that. It was just like a lot of hollering and screaming, raising my voice a lot faster than what I should. Wasn't as tolerant, you know what I mean? If they made a mistake, well, I wasn't understanding of a small mistake. And looking back on that right there is when I noticed it, is when I saw it in my kids' faces.
Christy, did you ever get frightened of Byron at this time?
Not at that time. No, I was really ticked off. I thought, you know, come on, control yourself. These are kids. They make mistakes. And a lot of times he was very accusatory to say, you know, while I was gone, you just coddled the kids. Now they think they can get away with anything. You know, this is what happens when you baby the kids, that kind of a thing. I didn't feel afraid. Mm-hmm. I felt incredibly irritated. And really irritated that I had to go to the kids and say, look, obviously, you know, Dad is still getting used to being home. Have some patience. And he would go and apologize later. And, you know, that's a good thing. But they got tired pretty quickly mm-hmm. of apologies for the same thing over and over again. They lost their trust in him. And that was probably the most dangerous thing, you know, in their relationship.
Yeah, it's
not being able to trust their dad
too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you gotta understand too, this is right, I didn't even know there was a problem, you know, but I was thinking I could handle it on my own, and you know, it's not a big deal.
So when did you finally conclude that you had a problem?
Well,
when I told him.
Yeah, she told me. And
I bet you weren't listening the first time you were told.
No, he didn't listen for several months. It was about 6 months after he got back when I knew for sure, beyond a shadow of a doubt, it wasn't just irritability. He would shout out and talk in his sleep and toss and turn, and he would end up in our den on a tile floor just having the television on for noise all night long. And I would complain, you know, why aren't you sleeping in the bed? Good heavens, you've been gone all this time. Don't you want to sleep in a nice, comfortable bed? And he made excuses. Oh, you know, I didn't want to wake you up and I couldn't fall asleep and my back hurt, so I laid down on the floor. But it became really obvious that he was doing that so he could wake himself up so that he didn't have nightmares, you know, that he couldn't come out of. And I just gathered up all my resources, went online, and I had a handbook, a PTSD handbook and some other things, and just started trying to convince him. I was trying really to convince everybody at that point because people on the outside did not see. He was still quite able to put on a very good show for people on the outside, family included.
I wonder, Christy, parents. If this was hard for you because you're saying, man, this guy is so difficult to live with. And everybody's going, what are you talking about?
Yes.
He looks fine to us.
Yes. And it was like that for quite some time and with people who were close to me.
Yeah.
And I started to feel like maybe I was crazy every now and then. You know, I've lost my mind and maybe I'm just very sensitive about this.
Byron tried looking for help. He tried medication. He switched to liquor. Nothing was working. But it was one evening, a little over a year ago, when things got very frightening for the whole family. I'll talk with Christy and with Byron about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Marine Sergeant Byron Hancock got home from Iraq in the spring of 2005. Within months, both he and his wife Christy and their four kids knew something was wrong with Dad. It wasn't just his short temper or his nightmares or the trouble he was having sleeping. He'd changed. Christy finally convinced Byron that he needed professional help.
Well, I went and talked to a social worker at the VA here in College Station and had a little interview with her and walked out. The conclusion was that there was nothing wrong with me, that everything was okay. She might even said that maybe Christy's over-exaggerating or something like that. I don't know. But that was the end result. You know, you're all right, this, that, and the other.
And did you buy that at the time? I mean, you knew what was going on at home. If she said everything was all right, what were you thinking? That it's normal to sleep on the floor with a television on and stuff like that?
Yeah, I didn't even think anything about that, about all that stuff. But,
when he walked through the door that afternoon and said, she said there's nothing wrong to me, I just flipped my lid. That's when I called her, and I was hysterical. I don't even remember what I said to her on the phone, but she made a very quick turn and scheduled an appointment for both of us to come in and meet with a psychiatrist through a teleconference. And basically, I told him everything that was happening with Byron, and he prescribed three different medications and said, come back in 3 weeks, mm-hmm. 2 weeks. And we went to the front desk there at the VA in College Station to schedule the appointment, and the first appointment was in 3 months. So he had just been prescribed three different medications, two of which were antidepressants.
And you weren't going to be able to get back in. Yeah, you weren't going to be able to get back in and see anybody for another 3 months.
Exactly. The funny thing was, when the medication came through the mail, on the bottles it stated that these medications were for the treatment of PTSD and its symptoms. We were still, however, going through the whole paperwork process, which is like jumping through hoops of fire and they had not given him a diagnosis at all, so we had to pay for the medication. And we continued to get bills for the medication that they sent us because, as of that time, they didn't have a diagnosis for him. I thought it was a little odd for them to medicate someone so heavily when they didn't even claim he had a problem at that point.
Byron, what was it like taking the drugs?
Oh, it made me feel, you know, lethargic, sluggish, tired in the morning, tired all the time. And finally, I was like, look, I am not going to be able to get back in touch with anybody for 3 months. I said, I'm not even going to take this stuff.
Did they make the nightmares go away? Anything like that, though?
Mm-mm.
No.
Made it impossible to wake up from
the
nightmares.
Yeah, they would give me a sleeping medicine, and I took it a couple of times. But what ended up happening was I'd get in such a deep sleep that when I had these nightmares, I couldn't get out of them. You know, so it seemed like the nightmare just continued on and on and on and on and on. And finally, I just quit taking them. I was like, I can't do this.
Byron Hancock soon found that beer worked better than prescription drugs. Eventually, there were times when he'd drink a pint of hard liquor before bed. He was still working as a police officer then, and things weren't so bad at work. It was on his days off, at home, where he drank. February of last year was the low point. Byron had been persuaded to go to an alcohol treatment program. He'd just come home from that. His wife, Christy, and the kids were hoping things would be different, but when she got home from work that day, Christy knew that something wasn't right.
When I walked into the house, all of the lights were off. The television had some kind of a really gruesome war movie going, you know, something very graphic, Hamburger Hill or Platoon or something like that. And I noticed that a lot of Byron's, I guess you would call it, memorabilia from Iraq, he had gotten out photo albums and letters and things like that. They were kind of strewn around our den, and on our kitchen counter was another letter from the VA that said, "We are still processing your claim. We need this, this, and this." Yeah. And we'd already sent this, this, and this. And I thought, okay, well, he's ticked off about this letter. And he was in the backyard with the boys and all the neighborhood kids, and they were playing ball, but I could tell something was not right. And when he came into the house, he was just bright red, extremely agitated. And he had been drinking, but he was obviously not drunk. You know, he no slurred speech, was in full control of his faculties. And when I started to question him about what was going on, he just became irate. He was furious with me and said he was going to put the boys in the truck and they were going to go get their baseball gloves because they had tryouts the next week for baseball season. And I argued with him and I said, I don't think you're in any condition to go anywhere with the kids. We need to sit down and talk. He became extremely angry and went to get his keys, and I took them first. And
these are the truck keys you're talking about?
Uh-huh. And he was reaching and grabbing for them, and it scared our teenage daughter enough to the point where she called first my father-in-law, and then she called my mother, who had just recently moved into our town. And my mother showed up, and Byron was trying to load the kids into the truck to take them and get baseball gloves. He was still extremely angry. And my mom and I said, no, you guys have to get in the car. We're going to go over to Dee Dee's house, to my mom's house, for a little while and let Dad, you know, have some time alone to cool off. And he started shouting at me and calling me names in front of my mother, and he would never, never do that. You know, I think that would be the last person he would ever do anything scary in front of would be my mother. And somehow we got all of the kids into the car, and I had hidden the keys in our bedroom while he was distracted. And I was going to stay and sit down and try to reason with him, but he was so angry with me that he went in, closed the garage door, and I heard him slam the door on the inside. And so I just said, Mom, I'm just going to come over to your house for a little while. We'll give him some time to cool off.
Byron, do you have any recollection of what Christie's talking about here? Do you remember this afternoon?
No, I remember playing ball with kids and everything, but I don't. It was just, it's all a blur. I remember the end of it, you know, but I don't remember what all happened in the middle.
What happened to Christie?
We went over to my mother's, and she's just a few blocks away, and we decided to order pizza, and I sat down with the kids, and I said, guys, you know, something is not right with Dad. I don't know if he's had a really hard day. You know, maybe he spoke to one of his friends from Iraq. We had gotten bad news days before. So the kids were starting to relax and sit down, and we had ordered some pizza when there was a knock on the door, and it was Byron, and he had gotten on. He has a bicycle that he rides for exercise, and he had gotten on that and come over to my mom's house, and he started to argue with me right in front of the kids and my mom, telling me that he had to have those keys and he had to have them quick or something terrible was going to happen. And I convinced him to come into one of the back rooms so that we could talk quietly and not in front of the kids. And he proceeded to tell me that he had slit our neighbor's throat and one other person, and that he had to get out of town immediately because the police would be there. And I just looked at him and said, well, honey, I think if you slit somebody's throat, you probably have blood on you, and you don't. And he said, well, not if you know how to do it the right way. And I decided at that point not to argue with him, and all I could think of was that just the more time that I spend talking to him, the more likely he is to come out of this before anything terrible happens. You know, I was just buying myself time. That was it.
Were you afraid for your own safety at this point, though?
No, I was very afraid for him. I was not afraid for
myself. Did he do himself some damage?
Yes. I really thought that he would kill himself. I talked to him at my mom's, for about 10 minutes or so, just trying to clarify. And he would seem to start to agree with me, and then his anxiety would build back up. He looked like someone who was truly running from danger. He really did look like that. Finally, I realized I was not going to talk him out of it. And I even tried to convince him that I needed to go with him. I said, you're not getting rid of me that easy. I'm sorry, but you made a promise to me, and I'm going with you. Wherever you're going, I'm going. And he would laugh at that, and then he would turn around and say, I can't protect you and the kids if I stay here. I can't protect all of you from what's about to happen. And finally, I lied to him and told him I had put the keys in some spot in our room, which was not true. And he took off his wedding ring and gave it to me. And it scared me to death. I really thought, well, he's not planning on ever coming back. If he's going to hand me this wedding ring, that was the final straw. He got on the bike and he went over to our house. And the minute I knew he was kind of out of sight, I took my mom's car keys and beat him to the house. And I have to say, when I came around the corner, I half expected to see our neighbor, you know, slaughtered on the driveway. I was not real sure what I was going to find. Was relieved that that had not happened. And I beat him to the house. He had not made it over to the house yet. And the first thing that I noticed when I did pull in was that he had taken the blinds down out of the front bedroom, which was our daughter's, both of the girls' bedroom, and those had been removed and were in the back of his truck. And I got out of the car and was walking into the side entrance at the garage when he pulled up on his bicycle and he said, well, honey, what are you doing here? In the calmest voice. And I said, oh, you know, I didn't take any clothes for the kids to mom's house. And, you know, if we're going to have to stay there, I need to get clothes. And I just wanted to come and check on you. And for the next 3 hours, 4 hours, I don't know, I completely lost track of time. We carried on a conversation like that. We went into the house. I asked him to please explain to me what his plans were. Inside the house was complete disarray. He had gone into the attic and taken down all of his camping and military gear. It was all over the place. you know, as if he was just digging through, looking for whatever he needed to survive and stuffing it here and there. And he let me heat him up a bowl of soup, and he would talk about the past, and he talked about dating in high school, and he talked about playing football, and then he would talk about not being able to live this life anymore this way, that it was just too difficult. And
did you eventually see him coming back, though?
It took a long time. I convinced him to sit down and watch an old episode of Grey's Anatomy that I had taped and had been waiting to share with him. And we sat down on the couch, and every now and then he would get distracted by that. And I just kept telling myself, the more time we spend talking, the less likely he is to really leave. And a few hours passed, and we were just kind of snuggled up on the couch, and I was leaning against him, and I turned around to look at him, and he said, I think I need to apologize. And I said, it's okay. I had a bad day. And he said, no, I really do need to apologize, and I need to thank you for showing me what was real. And I could tell then when I looked at him that it was him, you know, that he understood what was going on. I convinced him to take a shower, and while he was in the shower, I called his father, who immediately got in the car and started the drive to our house. And at that point, Byron was absolutely exhausted, like he'd run a marathon, and he lay down on the bed and fell into a really fitful sleep. His dad and I stayed up and watched him through the night, and he tossed and turned, and that was how that night ended.
Byron, what do you remember of that?
Well, I remember the end of it, you know, just sitting on the couch with her, looking around, seeing everything pulled out and in disarray, and I didn't know what I could believe, you know, what she was telling me. I just couldn't believe it. I was like, no, I wouldn't do that. It just sounded too far-fetched, you know. I just couldn't believe it.
Tell me, when you listened to Christy describe that day and how you'd frightened the kids and how you were rushing around on the bike and how you were unpacking camping, what's it like for you to hear that story about yourself?
Well, embarrassed, kind of ashamed, definitely not proud of it, you know. I don't know, that's about it. I just not very proud of that.
I'm talking with Byron Hancock and his wife Christy. Byron served in Iraq as a sniper for the Marines. He has since been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. I asked Byron how he tries to make sense of his PTSD. Is it the faces of the people he saw through the scope of his sniper's rifle? Is it thinking about the people that he shot?
I don't regret what I did, I can tell you that. Because at the time, it was a different type of environment, you know what I mean? I would never do that over here, I can tell you that.
No, I understand that. It's not a job that you're there. You're saving the lives of the people who you're there with.
And that's the way I looked at it. So I don't feel regretful in that respect. You do see the faces. And I don't know if I've been told they'll never go away. But that's just something you got to make peace with, you know what I mean? But a lot of flashback stuff I have are just moments of just, you know, because you never know when somebody's going to come up behind you and you're laying out there in a hide by yourself with just you and another guy. And if you get compromised, well, that's it. You're done. And that was pretty much the scariest part. You just try to do everything you can not to get compromised, not to get spotted. Because once they spot you, they're coming after you. So I think that was one of the most worrisome times, you know, because I wasn't responsible only for myself, but for somebody else.
When I come back, more on what Byron Hancock saw in Iraq and how he finally found one place that could give him the help he needs. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Marine Sergeant Byron Hancock went to Iraq in late 2004. He spent months at the leading edge of combat, often in hiding as a Marine sniper. He came home with a severe case of PTSD, one that has consumed him and his wife Christy and their four children. Part of the trouble for Byron is that while Iraq is the source of his nightmares and flashbacks, it's also a place where he saved lives and did some of the bravest and best things he's ever done. He remembers one story from the city of Hit.
I'd received fire from a guy that was, I knew he was a sniper, just because, you know, when they train us in counter-sniper operations, you can tell when another sniper's shooting, you know, just by the way they fire, different things like that. You know, they never shoot from the same place twice, things like that. So I had passed it on, and, you know, I know there was one in there, in the city, but I never saw him, couldn't get a shot at him, none of that stuff. So we left, went Fluzy, Ramadi, and all that stuff. We come back to Hit and met up with some of the human extraction team or something like that. Anyway, they go around and interview all the locals and gather information from them and things like that.
Yeah.
Well, the staff sergeant in charge of that group said he was standing by the inner traffic circles one day, and something just told him to take a step. He took a step back, and that sniper shot right in him. He said it probably creased his nose, and he said it scared the fire out of him. But that sniper there, he had killed a couple Marines while we were gone.
You're a sniper. You knew this guy was good.
Well, I knew just from him shooting at us the first time, I knew he had some training. I knew he knew what he was doing. When I see that, well, then I get – you don't want to underestimate that individual because there's no room for error in counter-sniper operations. If you mess up, well, you're not going home. So – anyway, we were sitting out there, and it had been quiet for the latter part of the day, and kids were out in the street playing, and women and children walking down the market, and all this, that, and the other, and then all of a sudden, I look up, and the streets are clear. There's nobody outside, and that's a telltale sign that something's been happening. And sure enough, about an hour later, I heard just a single shot, fired in the distance. I kind of tell where it's coming from, but I couldn't really get a fix on his position. So I had my observer at the time, Corporal Delano, said, "Why don't you go over that wall there, and I'll look over here, and you look over there." I said, "But don't stick your head up too high." I said, "Because there's a sniper out there somewhere, and if he sees you sticking your head up with them binos, he's liable to shoot you right between the eyes." Sure enough, I went around the side, and he shot right at Delano and hit the wall right below him. I mean, it probably missed him by about 6 inches. When he did that, it gave me an opportunity to find a position. So I fixed on a position. I started looking at him, and I saw the guy leave out of his hide. He was up on a hill. He was in some rubble. Made a good position. And I watched all through the night. And then the next morning, the sun was coming up behind us a little bit, and I was looking through the binos into the rubble pile, and I saw it's like a small flash. I knew it was coming off some type of optics. And when I saw that, I knew it was him. So I threw my rifle up there, and at this time he had crawled out of his hide, and I could see he had black hair, had a black beard, and I could see his dragged-off sniper rifle, his scope, and I'd already determined the range to each one of those positions, that I had thought that he might come back to. thinking that he wouldn't be stupid enough to shoot from the same place again. So as I throw my rifle up there and get him into the sights, he fired and missed. One of the sergeants was standing on a roof, and it missed his head by about an inch. And then right after he fired, well, then I shot and took him out. So,
how did you know you'd hit him?
I saw him drop. But see, up there you couldn't really you couldn't confirm it unless it had to be confirmed by, you know, another individual, or you had to see the body or whatever. But anyway, after about 30 minutes after I shot, there are six guys in black man dresses walked up the hill, and some of the MAP team guys on the backside that were on the Humvees saw him carrying a guy off the hill, and he'd been shot in the head. So, and then after that, the whole city, they all came outside and started rejoicing, inviting us into their homes. I mean, that was the first time that I've been in Iraq that I actually felt like we were doing some good.
And not just for American soldiers, but for the people in the city, the Iraqis, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because apparently what this guy was doing was he would just shoot a civilian for no reason. And that's how he controlled them, was by fear. They told Corporal Flyers one time, 2 days ago, y'all killed an insurgent. And he said, when y'all did, the entire city rejoiced. And after that, you could walk down the streets, and people were shaking your hand, patting you on the back, inviting you into their house, trying to give you food. I mean, it was just, the environment changed dramatically.
Byron Hancock is proud of what he did in Iraq, but he had no idea that the danger he faced there would come back to him in such force or in such seemingly safe environments as his own living room. He and his wife, Christy, have gone through a lot just trying to understand where the other one's coming from.
When you're around your buddies and stuff like that that were in the same predicaments you were in, you can relate and you feel comfortable. But when you get home, you're by yourself. And it's hard to adjust to, it's hard to talk to people who wasn't there.
You have to watch what you say.
Yeah, because, you know, you just can't. Of course, everybody wants to hear the war stories and all that junk, you know. But that, after a while, it just gets old, you know.
Well, and a lot of the guys went back. They just couldn't make it here, and they felt more comfortable in that situation. And Byron said over and over again, if he hadn't promised us he wouldn't go back, he would have gone back.
And that's true. There were times where I was very close to going back. I was just like, I've had it. I've had enough of this civilian life crap. I'm fixing to go at least over there. That's a comfort zone. You know what I mean?
At least you know who the enemy is there.
Yeah. Plus, that type of environment was kind of, I hate to say comfortable after a while, but you got accustomed to it.
How about the two of you? It's been 2 years now, better than 2 years since Byron got back. How are the two of you doing?
I'll let her answer that.
Well, listen, I think a lot of people would have given up on a marriage. When you guys describe what you've been through, you are still together. That says something.
Mm-hmm. We've been dating since we were just kids. We met when I was 12 and started dating when I was 14. And I know the real Byron. And it's like I've said before, even when your mind forgets, your heart remembers who they are and what they want and the real person. You remember the real person.
But you've got to go through this, Christy, thinking that the real person's coming back. It's not just remembering him. It's just a memory.
Every now and then you catch a little glimpse of that person. The real Byron would be there, and I would know, you know, in there somewhere is Byron, not this stranger who came home. And there were times when I was just so resentful of the man that was standing in front of me, because it's not that I just lost my loved one, it's that this stranger had come and taken his place, and I felt like sometimes like I was looking at my husband's murderer, looking into his face. I wanted to grab him and shake him until he let my husband go. And but every now and then I could see the real Byron, and it was enough to remember that, yeah, I like him. I guess I'll keep him around.
What are you thinking, Byron?
What am I thinking? Oh, I'm just glad she's around, because I tell you what, if it hadn't been for her, I don't know if I'd be here, to be honest with you.
Well, I guess you guys are pretty lucky to have each other then.
Some days.
Yeah.
Certainly takes a lot
Ask
of courage.
Us tomorrow.
It certainly takes a lot of courage for both of you to look as hard and as carefully and as closely at what's going on in your lives and to share it with us. And I appreciate your spending that time with us.
Well, you're welcome.
You're welcome.
Now, since that conversation with Byron and Christy Hancock, the family has had some good news. Byron is now staying at a trauma recovery program in Palo Alto, California, a place that's run by the VA. I reached him on the phone there, in between counseling sessions, and asked him to tell me a little bit about what it's like.
Yeah, well, we get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, go eat chow at the chow hall down here, and then we start into classes, you know, classes on belief systems, our, you know, our old belief systems, behaviors. When you first get here, one big difference you have between this and the other programs, you actually tell them what your issues are, you know, like some of mine were anger, isolation, anxiety, those type of things. And from that, they really focus on dealing with each one of those personally, you know what I mean? And that's a big difference. It's still a community-type setting. You know, there's, I don't know how many guys there's in here, 20-something maybe or 30 guys. But and so you have a community aspect of it too, but you also get the individual focus on your treatment and your program as well. So,
now, does this go through the weekend as well?
Well, actually, on the weekends, we have the weekends off. We go out with our peers. And with that, it's still focused on your program. Say, like, for instance, if I had anxiety issues about being in big crowds, then they want you to go out with your peers and go into places where you have large crowds, like, you know, Walmart or whatever, so that you actually start dealing with some of those issues rather than avoid them. Just do a little, you know, if you get into a crowd and kind of gets uneasy, then you can back out for a minute and, you know, slowly, progressively deal with it. So even the weekends are still, you still have a focus on what your objectives are and, you know, the overall outcome of your treatment. So
I remember you talking to me about your frustration with anger, that you had a hard time controlling your temper and that bothered you. Is this something that you get to address directly at the center?
Yeah. Yeah. They give you ways of dealing with it. The big thing is helping you identify that the anger's coming on and kind of what triggers you have. And then when you feel it start to come on, they give you ways of dealing with it.
Give me a couple of examples.
Oh, well, you know, just dealing around with large crowds, getting in crowd, I had a tendency to get real angry, frustrated with things the way they were going. Now I feel it coming on, and so you're able to use like deep breathing techniques and start to think about, you know, what's happening to you. So it's just not—it's not all overwhelming at once, you know. I can feel it coming on, and it's gradual, and I can start thinking about a way to not let it come out as, you know, anger outbursts or just getting so mad that you walk away from the situation and really don't make any progress, you know.
And what's your sense of how it's going?
I think I'm making pretty good progress. It's a lot different than anything I've had before. I'm able to actually see some progress, you know. And two, some of the stuck points are, you know, where in the past I wouldn't be able to get past them, whereas here I can go talk to somebody or they can give me ways of dealing with a certain issue and getting past it and moving on.
And as you were saying, there's about 30 others there who are dealing with their various forms of PTSD, and I'm wondering, is that a good thing for you to be around other people who you know are going through some of the same issues that you are?
It is. It's good to, in the sense that you're not alone, you know, and everybody has different traumas or different issues they're dealing with, but in the end, it's all about the same, you know. The emotional reactions are the same, the thought processes are the same, and it's good to know that I'm not a freak or something, you know.
And when you're in one of the sessions with the other Marines, the other soldiers, do you get a chance to give them a shoulder when they're having a bad time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's pretty much on a daily, usually every day somebody's dealing with something around here. And, yeah, you get to help them out. And it helps you look at yourself, too, you know, dealing with somebody else and their problems gives you a chance to look at yourself and how you deal with or how I deal with my problems.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Byron Hancock has been at this center now for nearly 2 months. He talks to his family regularly on the phone, and he's looking forward to coming home, but the hardest work is just starting. Now that he's picked up some basic tools for dealing with anger and anxiety, Byron's now in a class where he looks directly at the events that caused so much trauma.
It's a slow-going process. I mean, it's every day. So, it didn't happen overnight, and it's not going to get better overnight, but that's why trauma groups are 6 weeks long. So, you know, and they give you homework, stuff to work on, so you actually break the individual event down, you know, in sections and digest it or whatever.
And how does it work at the end? Does someone say, well, Byron, I think you're ready to go home? Is that your call? How does that work?
No, and I asked that same question. Dr. Alvarez here has assured me that once we're over with the trauma class, then we'll sit down and she'll go over it and we'll talk about it. And I guess we'll make an informed decision on if I'm at a point to where I can go home or if I need to do more or what. So it's not just you're in the program, you're done, go to the house type thing. You know, it's all a process, and there's a lot of minds a lot smarter than mine working on fixing you.
Well, it sounds like a good thing if they're in fact tailoring it to each individual person.
Yeah, yeah, and that's been the difference between this program and the other ones I've been to. You know, I've been caught up in the fact, well, you know, well, it's not doing me any good. You know, I'm not being able to work on anything. Well, here's this problem. Well, there's no way to fix it. Well, here they give you a way to start dealing with it, you know.
And when will you know, Byron? When will you know you're ready to go home?
I don't know. I guess I'll know when it comes to that point, you know, when we sit down and talk about it. Because right now I'm just starting a trauma class.
Yeah.
It seems kind of overwhelming for right now, you know. And part of me wants to get here, deal with it, so that I can move on with my life. But on the other hand, I'm kind of apprehensive as, you know, will I be able to do that?
Yeah.
So I guess that's what we'll sit down and talk about whenever we're to that point. I'm just glad I'm here. And I wish a lot more people knew about it, because for me it was frustrating not having any help, and then finally hearing of a place that you could actually get some help was kind of give you some more hope, you know what I mean? I didn't have much hope left, you know. So it's good to have hope again.
Well, Byron, good luck to you. I must say, it's really good to talk to you. I hear more of a bounce in your voice than the last time we spoke, and that's encouraging.
Well, thanks. Thanks.
Byron Hancock is a veteran getting treatment at the Trauma Recovery Program of the VA in Palo Alto, California. He and his wife, Christy, live in Bryan, Texas. If you have any thoughts about today's program or a suggestion of a story for your own, I'd like to hear from you. Get in touch with me at our website. That's thestory.org. Or call and leave a message at 1-888-966-9862. Again, that's 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.